Welcome back to Midnight Grappler Animals, home of Flub Nation. I'm your host, Lan, and with me I've got three co-hosts, not just one this time. We're, our studies in Ditkoology and Ditkonomics have really boosted the mass appeal of our University of Steve Ditko, and we've got two other students here. Students, why don't you introduce yourself to the class?
I'm Keegan. I'm learning.
Hey, I'm Serge. Just a disciple of Ditko, I guess, now. Now we're jumping into objectivism and all that.
Yeah, I'm a grad student, Salt, and I brought enough Ditko to share with the whole class.
Wow, so nice. So nice. That's right. So we're back for the last, and this time we really do mean last. I don't know how much blood we can squeeze out of this stone. The last entry in our Ditkoology series. We've done Ditkoology, we've looked at Ditkonomics, and this time we're wrapping things up with Ditcontinuity. We're going to be looking at three separate comics with some more stuff at the end there, and wrap up our analysis into Steve Ditko's weird objectivist career. So, Salt, I want to start with you, because last time we talked about some of the comics, we mentioned some of the comics that we're covering today. Now that you've actually read them, how things changed?
I mean, I still get a weird, sick enjoyment out of hack-era Ditko, and I see he like sunk even further in some ways. But there's an inclusion in here that shows that by the 90s, he did still have it. He could still do a good page.
Yeah.
That's the most important thing for now. What about you, Lan?
Before I get to my own thoughts, we'll talk to our new students here, Keegan and Serge. What were your first impressions? Well, actually, hold on. Did you know that Steve Ditko worked on the comics that we're talking about today prior to doing this episode?
No.
Absolutely not. I did not.
Were you surprised to learn that he did some of these comics?
Yeah. like it doesn't make any. I don't understand this guy. I don't understand him at all. Something's wrong. I don't know.
Like last episode, we were like, Steve Ditko must have fallen on hard times or did something real crazy to end up at Squirrel Girl. But then you realize that like that was after he did the Chuck Norris comic, after he did like a ton of other licensed comics. And just like a couple years before he did Power Rangers.
Yeah. There's something there. Like most of the comics we're going to talk about are so much for kids. Like extremely dumb. Like not good kids comics either. Just like
slop.
Very, very blunt and just an instrument to deliver some action and some lesson.
And also and like, sell toys too.
Yeah.
Like these are very Reagan era or post Reagan era comics.
Yeah, and I mean with comics, a lot of the time, right? It's the question of was the comic selling the toy or did the toy sell the comic, or some part of some triangle, including TV shows too. I don't. This feels like more like he had to have needed the money, but also what I'm trying to get into his brain. I'm channeling. We'll figure it out. We'll get there. I don't know. What a crazy guy, though.
What about you, Serge?
Yeah, I felt like, you know, those commercials where Orson Welles is selling frozen peas, like late career. It feels like that. I actually found from the New York Times in 2008 a description of like late era Ditko. It says, by the 70s, he was regarded as a slightly old-fashioned oddball. By the 80s, he was a commercial has-been, picking up wretched work-for-hire gigs. Bell suggests, following the example of Rand's John Galt, Ditko hacked out money-making work, saving his care for the crabbed objectivist screeds he published with tiny presses. And boy, could Ditko hack. Seeing samples of his Transformer coloring book and his Big Boy comic is like hearing Orson Welles sell frozen peas.
Oh my God.
Just like, this was in the New York Times.
God, people used to be able to hate.
Yeah. Efficiently too. Efficiently.
Now they can because of woke.
Yeah.
Oh, I wish the New York Times was doing diss tracks on has-been artists instead of war crime apologia.
Yeah.
So true.
Oh man.
Yeah, where is the New York Times diss track on Morrissey when you need it?
Yes.
Preferable.
Oh man.
But yeah, Serge, you were saying?
So I was gonna say the next sentence is amazing too. The portrait that emerges here is of an artist whose principles have ossified into bitter perversity. And I sort of think about, like, man, Ditko's kind of like a horror story of what every like comic artist or writer tells themselves not to be, but also we kind of see as the norm right now too. So it's just kind of like this really bizarre, like, I don't know. I feel really weird about it because, you know, like, you get a lot of like the DC and like Marvel comic artists are like going, oh, I'm never going to sell out. And they're like, well, Kamala Khan need to be a mutant because the MCU demanded it. So we did it. You know, just like, okay, yeah. Well, so it's just sort of like weirdly, like, this is a man who willingly did this to himself, apparently. And that makes it even more bizarre, I think, than, like, you know, some of these people just trying to, like, still convince themselves they're earning a living.
Yeah. And I think his philosophy really factors into that, too. But just the idea of objectivism and adhering to that and, like, what that actually means in regards to, like, being productive and putting out the work, which is why I've sort of shifted my thinking on, like, yeah, Ditko was doing hack work, but, like, the reason for doing the hack work, it wasn't because he was like, I don't know. I don't think he was aching for money is the thing. Like, because the thing is, he was sitting on literal gold. He had original pages from his Spider-Man days that he could have easily sold off for money, and yet he didn't.
Has anyone here seen the BBC special about In Search of Steve Ditko?
I've seen clips from it. Well, there's the one clip where they're talking about, like, how he was using some originals as, like, cutting boards, right?
Yeah, there's anecdotes about that, like, about how he hates his art. But there's also an allusion to talking to Ditko's bank teller and her saying something to the host, like, oh, yeah, this guy's account, it goes on forever. Like, you know, you can trust the source or not, but they seemed pretty confident in that documentary to claim that Ditko wasn't suffering financially.
Good to know. Good to know. This is a man of strong ideals and big bank accounts.
Big baller Steve Ditko.
Big baller Steve Ditko.
I love how when you start investigating Steve Ditko, he kind of just like has the life story of a supervillain.
Him being a recluse, he doesn't want to see anyone, he's just hatching and scheming. You'll send a postcard like, and you, there's like a 2% chance there might be anthrax in the reply.
He was just born on Earth Prime. So sad. Any other Earth, it would have been amazing.
The ultimate cruel twist of fate was that Steve Ditko's writer was Jeff Johns.
Oh, man. That makes sense.
Oh, my gosh.
Everything clicked. Everything finally clicked 6 years on from his death. Do we want to jump into the first of our books today?
Yeah, let's get it.
I honestly hesitate to call this one a book. It really is a product. You know, if we were some kind of podcast that did, I don't know, kayfabes of the cartooning variety, we might even say that this is his jobber era. I don't know if I can be making jokes like that nowadays. Our first topic is going to be Chuck Norris and the Karate Commandos. Does anyone remember Chuck Norris and the Karate Commandos? Is anyone here old enough to remember Chuck Norris and the Karate Commandos?
I think this is before everybody's time. Yeah, I didn't even realize this was an action figure line.
Yeah
this is like a whole show.
This was a whole show.
It was a whole show. There was a Karate Commandos TV miniseries.
Okay. Yeah, this was a year before I was born, so.
Damn. Yeah. Okay.
Wow, this is like one of those cartoons they would make fun of on like Adult Swim. They would make like a fake cartoon that would be this kind of thing.
I'm pretty sure they parodied this in the 2012 Ninja Turtles cartoon too.
The six sidekicks of Trigger Keaton. This is definitely the inspiration of one of the shows in that book. Good book.
You're right. Yeah. Very good book. Right, so what do we have to say about Chuck Norris and Karate Commandos? Here's some preamble. So this was made for Marvel's Star Comics imprint. If you're wondering what the Star Comics imprint is, that's where Peter Porker, Spider-Ham, and Heathcliff. Remember Heathcliff? That's where they were serialized for a little bit there. It's also just the home of Marvel's licensed comics outside of, I think, Transformers at the time. So lots of licensed comics there. Like I mentioned, it was based on the Karate Commandos TV miniseries made by Ruby Spears. So this was a cartoon. And this comic ran for 4 issues from January to July of 1987. It was written by Joe Duffy, a famous... what story was it, Salt, from the 9/11 issue that she wrote?
Oh, God, I don't remember.
It was the one... It was a really, really bad... Oh, it's the one where she compared... I think it was Al-Qaeda to rats. Is that the one? Okay. That
sounds right.
So just setting the bar here for what to expect with this comic. It was written by her. It was drawn by Steve Ditko. And it was colored by Glynis Oliver. So the colors are good. But yeah, Chuck Norris and the Karate Commandos. I read the first issue. Salt, it seems like you read more than just the first issue.
I didn't realize there was more than one issue. No, I only read the first issue.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I want to talk about one of our main themes here, which is character model sheets, and that those were not getting to Steve, or Steve wasn't really looking at them. Like, Chuck Norris has this superhero emblem on his chest, like Superman. It's a C and an N, and it wasn't until, like, I looked at the stills from the animation that I realized they're doing this thing where the C and the N are sort of supposed to be like Eastern style letters, the C and the N should look like a character from the Chinese alphabet, something like that. And then you look at it here and it just looks like he doesn't know how to draw the letter C.
I mean, it looks like he doesn't even know what Chuck Norris looked like.
Yeah, he doesn't look like Chuck Norris at all, honestly.
He doesn't. Well, the cover much more also, like, it's hilarious.
Hold on, now I actually got to look at the actual cartoon, because...
Yeah, whatever.
The cartoony kind of looks like Chuck Norris. Like, it still is off. But yeah, my point here is Ditko, like, didn't get the model sheets here, or, like, just looked at them once and didn't look again.
He's probably, I don't get it.
Wrong apartment.
Yeah.
Oh, he's missing his signature ascot. Shake my head.
Damn.
Yeah, so what is everyone's initial thoughts on this comic?
Not good. It's real not good. Real bad, maybe.
I mean, this is one of those comics you buy your kid at a store to get him to shut up. And, you know, like, it's like one of
and
those.
They don't
it's
shut
like,
up. It doesn't work. Yeah.
In fact, it gets worse, much worse.
Yeah. No one actually wins in this scenario.
Oh, I see why Lan thought I read more. Yeah, I did glance ahead. I didn't really read closely. Oh, okay. But yeah, Ditko has this really specific way he nopes out of a book where he gets a short contract and then he, like, steadily does less work on it. He never hard outs in one issue. So he did the same thing on The Creeper and Hawk and Dove with this book. Like, he's all in on the first issue. Second issue, he's like 90% there. You can see some of the faces are drawn by somebody else. You get to the third issue and it says layouts or breakdowns by Ditko. And he's just checked out at that point.
Quiet quitting, King.
Quiet quitting. Let's go.
No one wants to work anymore.
Millennial pioneer, Steve Ditko.
True trailblazer.
True. The silent generation doesn't want to work anymore.
I have an important coloring note too, Lan, on that note. Could anyone else see how they had clearly recolored the teacher?
Did they?
If you look at the teacher, it's very weird.
Like, she's, around the hair?
Yeah, she's portrayed as a darker-skinned woman, presumably African-American. But you can see around her face, parts of her face, at the hairline, sometimes around the hands too. She was clearly meant to be a Caucasian woman. At some point.
Yeah, I thought that was like a scan thing.
Yeah, I thought
I assume
that was like a scan issue, but maybe you're right, honestly.
Yeah.
It's
especially
really weird.
Page 6, that first panel is like, there's a lot of that happening, huh?
It doesn't happen with any other character. It's very weird.
Yeah, oh, well, I see this. There's Splotchy on page 7 on the whatever awful child who didn't
too
read
much.
Last time.
Yeah.
Is, that, is
yeah.
that what his name is? Too much?
Too much.
Too yeah. much.
There's also just so much dialogue in this comic.
For an insane reason. Amount.
For a comic that's supposed to be like, Chuck Norris fights ninjas. How cool is this? It's like, let's just have a crap load of dialogue at all times.
Can you believe that this was written by the same person who adapted Naruto to English?
Wow.
Oh my gosh.
That person seems like they would be way too old to be adapting Naruto to English.
I wonder what her opinions on 9/11 are.
Yeah, Lan, you have some notes here about propaganda. Can you get into some of that?
Okay, so a significant portion of this book is about this book report that Too Much has to do about James Clavell's The Children's Story. I don't know if anyone here has read it. I haven't read it. But, you know, we've all been Clavell-pilled recently because we've all watched Shogun. I looked a bit into the Children's Story and, like, what it was about. And it was just about, like, propaganda and... Anyway, it seems like a pretty anodyne story, if anything. But it's like a significant plot point in this issue where the climax is the book, like the children's story book, preventing a bullet from hitting, I think it was Chuck Norris himself, right? And at the very end, Chuck Norris is like, oh, I only have one regret. And that's that the book's been shot up. And then, you know, one of his ethnic sidekicks are like, oh, you're sorry because it's school property? And then Chuck Norris is like, no, but especially because it's a good book. And they're like, oh, yes, the children's story is a fine fable. So I don't know if they were, like, trying to plug the children's story specifically, but it really does feel like a weird kind of advertisement for it. Like, the entire comic honestly has this vibe of being, like, CIA propaganda in some ways, you know, like the weird orientalism, the Cold War elements of it. Like the villains are all like, if you were to put Cold War era Russian grunts, like your depiction, you know, like your caricatures of Russian grunts and your caricatures of Arab terrorist grunts, and you were to, like, put them in a hyperbolic time chamber and, like, crossbreeded them for, like, 100 years, this is what that would look like. So, yeah, generally, it's just, like, a very weird sort of, like, post-G.I. Joe kind of comic, where G.I. Joe is much more... Like, if you've read the Hama comics, you've read the Hama comics, right? But, like, here it feels much more, I don't know, cynical even?
Yeah.
Yeah, I
can see that.
I think that's partly Chuck Norris in general, though. Like, I think even at that time,
Was this pre or post Walker Texas Ranger?
I would assume pre.
I think it's pre. Yeah. But I think even by the time of Walker Texas Ranger, like, all that, I think... Maybe at the time it wasn't read as cynical, but I think now, after all of that, all of it looks so cynical and, like, cashing in on a, like, his popularity constantly, you know?
Yeah.
So, like, it doesn't
matter.
This
was...
Like, I think all of his stuff was the same kind of vibe, though.
Yeah, I mean, this was an allegation about Norris, even when, like, Bruce Lee died, that he was kind of, like, cynically cashing in on, like, his relationship with Bruce Lee at times. So, I mean, like... You know, not to get too far off track, but I mean, this is something that's, like, been with Chuck Norris since pretty much the beginning of his career, I think. Like, that idea of him just trying to, like, construct a business around himself, so to speak, you know?
Yeah, the like brand of Chuck off Norris. Of other things. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, how many other stars had this kind of thing going on?
Yeah,
I'm trying to think. Ice-T, maybe? Or not Ice-T.
Yeah.
Mr. T,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm more sympathetic to Mr. T because he was like a bouncer who literally worked his way up, mm-hmm, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's like kind of like you kind of get how someone like that would like build their way up. Whereas I don't think Nick Norris necessarily comes from privilege, so to speak. But like, you know, it does feel less or more calculated, I guess, on Norris's part, whereas Mr. T just kind of feels like I saw an opportunity and I just kind of rode it out as long as I could.
Yeah. Yeah,
that makes sense. Norris feels maybe more comparable to like The Rock now.
Yeah, yeah,
that's a good one.
If Chuck Norris was around now, he'd probably have his own like energy drink Like, yeah, he's still alive, right?
Yeah. Remember when he was on the Expendables? And he made that joke. He's like, they're like, I thought you got bit by a snake. He's like, yes. And after 3 days, the snake died. And I was just like, why is he making a Chuck Norris joke on a movie, you know, about himself? This is super weird.
Damn, he's 84.
I want to return to the concept of the children's story as the central motif of this book, because I didn't really realize that until you pointed that out, Lan, like how important the children's story is. So I read up on it, and it was James Clavell reacting to his daughter reciting the Pledge of Allegiance in school without knowing what it meant. Like, that was the impetus for starting this story. So the philosophy of that book in itself could be argued as like neutrally libertarian. But then what I do find really fascinating is that when it was adapted into a made-for-TV special, it was for mobile theater, as in like a nightly film segment hosted by ExxonMobil.
Oh,
so, like, let's go.
Just what is happening here? Why is this held with such reverence?
Oh, man.
So, yeah, there is some...
I'm like, I watched this thing on the little TV at the gas station, you know?
Like, weird CIA there if ExxonMobil is, like, sponsoring this TV adaptation. Yeah, that's really funny.
I also find it, like, really amazing to see Ditko be like, yes, this is what the center of the story should be for, like, this kind of...
Well, that's what's really funny, too, is Ditko is, like, pulling strings for the thematic elements for this cheesy work-for-hire stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. No, now, that's one of the insane things about him is, like, he this, especially, like, as I was going through, you know, Chuck Norris, Power Rangers, VR Rangers, all of it, it was like, man... This dude is trying to make stuff for kids, and it's awful. Like, he does not know how to do it at all. This is so boring and bad. I can't imagine why a child would enjoy this. But it's so aimed, and it's like, yeah, it is. It feels meaningful in that way, that, like, he is trying to make something meaningful for children that will influence them. And it makes me feel crazy.
Yeah, he's trying to, like, underline it with, you know, his own objectivist ideals. He's like, the medium is the message, and the message is, I'm going to get Chuck Norris to teach these kids about objectivist values.
Well, and speaking of not understanding kids, I love that the central setting here is the school children are taking a field trip to the International Anti-Terrorism Conference.
As a class does, you know, in the late 80s.
Yeah, this is really like a post 9/11 book. Before, I mean, again, Ditko was always ahead of the curve. He always knew where the culture was going.
Those planes were coming.
Yeah, he could see through the Mujahideen way back when.
Yeah, this book
those
stingray
missiles.
There's so little in this book, but it is kooky as hell. I really love how weird he's drawing faces here. Like, anytime he does the close-up on Too Much's face, it gets progressively more unhinged.
Yeah, that last panel of his face is he's insane.
Yeah.
Like,
that is like a 60-year-old, that's like a 40-year-old man in a 14-year-old's body.
He's pulling a crazy face. Is what he's doing.
The lack of an upper lip, too.
Yeah. Just,
he's cheesing it up. Those kids can't even see his face, and he is doing that for them.
Also, just in general, Ditko's action here is, like, really, really stiff. Like, there's the fight scene between Chuck Norris and those grunts, and he's, like, moving around like he's a puppet on strings. Like, he's quite literally just, like, flinging his arms around. I don't know if that's, like, Ditko trying to emulate, you know, martial arts of any sort. Like, I definitely couldn't play. Like, is he trying to do, like, Aikido? I wonder, was Steve Ditko watching, like, Steven Seagal movies before working on this? Because that could explain some of the poses in this book.
I mean, I feel like it could also just be they wanted to be able to let kids recreate these poses with their action figures.
I'm gonna be honest. I don't know if I could imagine a kid reading this comic and be like, yes, I want to pose my Chuck Norris action figure.
I'm not saying it's like a good idea or that any kid would actually want that, but I can see a comic creator being, ah, yes, kids would have Chuck Norris action figures and would want to recreate these scenes.
It just your average Ditko comic creator, sure, but Steve Ditko? Steve Ditko? You think Steve Ditko's thinking about that?
I mean, I can't think of any other reason why like his action would look the way it looks right now.
Steve Ditko's probably versus, you like, know, doing this comic and be like, wow, I can't believe kids are wasting their time and money on Chuck Norris action figures instead of being productive members of society and being
instead
heroes.
Of reading the children's groups, instead of reading James Clavell.
They should be picking up litter.
Yeah, they should be contributing to society and paying.
They should be reading the children's story.
Why aren't they paying their taxes?
I don't know, like if the series just kept going on and like Joe Duffy and Steve Ditko are like mind melding and putting in like some subliminal messaging, you know, like by issue 3 Chuck Norris's enemy is like the IRS. It's like, oh, the Dr. Claw has infiltrated the IRS and, you know, all your tax filings is been compromised.
They had to stop it. They had to stop this con from getting too powerful.
See, yeah, this is one of my things. Because it's like, you know, there's always the debate. The debate comes up every so often that like, oh, you guys don't treat right-wing art as good. And I'm like, you know what? If we had right-wingers writing things that were like destroying TurboTax or something, you know, if they were like dismantling some other second thing, then maybe it would be okay, you know, maybe you could make a good thing, you insane person. But Steve Ditko, you absolute crazy person, you were not making a good comic here.
I think he knew that. He definitely knew that. For him it was just, if he can get his name, it's almost like a check. Like a checklist, you know, like I need to get this many comics done for this year, that way I can be considered a productive person. And this was like item number 50 on the list.
Look, Keegan, I will give you I'll give you that much. Maybe Ditko wasn't making a good comic, but he was keeping some in the tank. He was like Goku holding back, and he needed his best powers reserved for Power Rangers.
Beautiful. Beautiful transition.
That was amazing. Incredible. Actually.
Mm-hmm. Almost an entire decade later, too. So Chuck Norris comics, that was 1987. We're jumping ahead now to 1995 and 1996. That's right. Power Rangers, Mighty Morphin Power Rangers. Class, is there anyone here who doesn't know about the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers? Please raise your hands. No, I'm not seeing any hands raised. Because we're not doing a video call.
The first time I went to Disneyland, I wished on a fountain, the wishing fountain by Mickey's house, I think, that I would never stop liking Power Rangers, and that's how I know magic.
When you wish upon a star,
it's fake.
Fake.
Yeah, I met the Power Rangers at a grocery store. The Red Ranger and the Blue Ranger were doing some kind of autographs. But the helmets were the wrong shape. They like only covered the front of the face, and they were like twice as tall. And so I knew these were imposters.
Fake. I could beat you up.
Yeah.
Using the methods I learned from the Red Ranger.
Did you guys know the Tooth Fairy isn't real either? It's kind of fucked up. But
this episode's a real bummer. Wow, bad vibes, Lynn.
Yeah, that was kind of.
Yeah, that was dark.
Marginal.
We need to disabuse the children of these notions so they can focus on more important things like being productive members of society and not
like
paying taxes.
Growing their teeth. God.
Well,
like,
you know,
up trash.
One thing I really appreciate about this Power Rangers book is a significant contribution it makes to the lore. There's a piece of storytelling fans might have wondered about that it was alluded to but not fully addressed in the Power Rangers TV show. And this book makes that crystal clear. Bulk and Skull are not pedophiles. Really glad that was cleared up.
Thank God we knew that. Thank God.
Yeah.
First page, they're not pedophiles. Woo! That's good.
Cleared the Drake standard. That's good.
Certified Power Rangers, certified.
Oh, man.
Yeah, so the story behind these comics is Marvel started doing tie-in comics for the Power Rangers TV show when it was in its third season. So by this time, Saban had also started experimenting with other toys based off of, you know, Japanese tokusatsu properties. So it wasn't just Power Rangers. They did VR Trooper comics. They did Masked Rider comics. Well, I say comics. It's only one comic. And they also went as far as to do Big Bad Beetleborgs comics too, but we're looking specifically at one issue of Mighty Morphin Power Rangers and one issue of VR Troopers. I'm going to ask the class again, how many people here don't know what VR Troopers is?
I didn't know what VR Troopers was.
You didn't know? I definitely remember VR Troopers.
Damn. So
I watched it. They kept moving it like... It's showtime round, so I couldn't watch it consistently, but I remember liking it more than Power Rangers.
Wow. Yeah, yeah, I wasn't around for the VR Troopers era. So this
You
is...
could say I was like the first toku head on the podcast. Oh, okay. If you wanted.
Makes sense. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so everyone knows the deal with Power Rangers and what the Power Rangers are. VR Troopers is pretty much the same thing. Except this time they're using footage from multiple Metal Heroes shows. So it wasn't just one show that they were taking footage from. It was like three or four shows across like 7 years. So the show ran for two seasons. This show ran for 92 episodes. Can you believe that? It's 92 episodes. And it probably would have gone longer if they didn't run out of footage.
Amazing.
So yeah, that this also got a comic. VR Troopers... the VR Troopers comic was also a double bill, so it was like a flip book comic, so we're at like, you had one comic on one side and the other comic on the other side. So on one side you had VR Troopers, and then on the other side you had the Ninja Rangers from Power Rangers. And, Steve Ditko was drawing, like, it's so crazy to me, just thinking about it, you know, like, Steve Ditko was not only aware of Power Rangers, but, like, knew Power Rangers on such an intimate level.
What do you mean by that?
Like, I don't know. Like, when you think about old people, and I don't know how often you do that. Like, when you think about, like, the kind of franchises that they are aware of, right? Or have engaged with, right? Like, you there's no expectation that, I don't know, a 70-year-old is going to know about, I don't know, like, Genshin Impact, right? Like, when you think about, like, Steve Ditko, who at this point is, I think, in his late 60s, right? And so you're like, there's no reason for him to know about Power Rangers.
Yeah.
And yet here he is doing Power Rangers comics.
Yeah, I was thinking about that too. And, like, the more direct point I have is, it's really wild that this dude created Spider-Man and then was in a position to do terrible licensed comics about Power Rangers decades later. That's wild. That's an insane thing
to think about. That's a dream right there.
Think about it. He was doing this at the same time that the Clone Saga was happening.
Like, that's crazy.
Oh, that is that weird. Really weird to think
about. On some level, the first Spider-Man movie was in development at this time. Like, to some degree, right?
Yeah, and maybe he was doing this for Marvel, too. So it wasn't like he was doing it elsewhere. He was literally doing it within the house where he created Spider-Man.
That does add an extra layer of irony.
That's nuts. But I also think a lot, this is more veering off topic, I think a lot about how, like, all children's entertainment, media, whatever, is made by adults. And, like, there's always a weird disconnect there to me in my brain of, like, especially anything that's not edutainment, because edutainment is, like, founded, all edutainment, even, like, the absolute trash, is founded in some amount of research, or is founded on something that was founded on some kind of research. It's so weird, adults choosing things almost by accident that kids are going to be obsessed with. And it's just really, it's like expanding that even more by having a 60-year-old Ditko doing Power Rangers, a thing that already in Ditko's adulthood, he defined children's lives with Spider-Man. And then now this entirely different cultural phenomena he is also a part of. And that is weird. That's a wild thing to, like, have happened.
But also you have to consider, like, the composition of the comics market too, just, like, creatively speaking. right? Like, what creators are working on this? Like, for instance, the writers on these books. Have you heard of Frank Lavisse?
No.
Never heard of him, right? And on the VR Troopers comic, it was Frank Strom. Have you heard of this writer, Frank Strom?
Are these pen names?
I wonder if they are. I wonder if it's like Alan Smithy.
Yeah, exactly. Comics. Yeah, that would make sense.
Yeah, couldn't be. You couldn't be caught working on a Power Rangers comic. Many such cases.
The art in this Power Rangers book, I gotta say, it is the most hack art of all the Ditko books we've done.
It's really funny because it feels like something that is honestly taken straight out of the 70s. Like, some of the faces feel very much like Creeper era Ditko, even like the action. And yeah, also I think the coloring also lends to that too, right? Where there's that layer separation. You haven't really quite gotten to the era of digital coloring yet, where like if you were to hand this to someone who had no idea what the Power Rangers were, right, and they were like, yeah, this is a comic from the 70s, do you think they would question it?
No, I think they'd believe you.
It's, I think so too, right?
The coloring is maybe the only giveaway, because it's a more modern coloring, but yeah, otherwise it would pass as a 70s book.
Yeah, he also just can't draw the suits for shit. The suits are just some of the most... There's this one shot of like the lineup of Rangers, you know, running at the camera, and it's just one of the worst things I've ever seen put to page.
Yeah, it's so sloppy. I mean, no one is entirely sure what they're drawing here. Like, even the colorist is not sure. On close-ups of the Rangers' masks, the mouth portion, they're not quite sure if it's still helmet or if that's like the real mouth underneath. So they pick this tone that's halfway between gray and flesh color. They're like, ah, that might be the real mouth under there. Who's to say?
It might be a corpse under that suit.
Yeah. But no one is entirely sure what they're drawing here. Like, the Rangers look awful and yet are the most on-model characters. Like, all of the evil henchmen here look like racist stereotypes for ethnicities that don't exist.
Yeah, yeah. Babu specifically looks like a really racist caricature.
Yeah, I'm some George Lucas here.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Amazing.
Yeah, and Babu, those two guys, they change their look in every panel. There's no model here. There's nothing to come back to. They're just completely amorphous. There is some stuff here that there's some like weird tonal disconnects. Like, when the pink and yellow ranger can't like morph to fight the bad guys, they pick up these art supplies to like spray them with like goo, and it is that like weird, like, who's that pedophile guy from Nickelodeon, like Dan Schneider? Yeah, it has like weird like kink vibes as they're like gleefully spraying squirt. The bad guy. Yeah,
squirting.
It's weird fetish stuff. It's squirt. Real creepy.
Oh man.
I thought that was ketchup. It must be.
It's not clear. Yeah,
and a little bit of mayo. And a little bit of mayo.
Oh man. Quiet on set. Quiet on set.
All quiet on set. Oh man.
But
those things was worse. Okay.
The clearest indicator of Ditko being a hack era here is the recycling of poses. Like, everybody will recycle a pose inevitably, but he will recycle a pose within the same panel. You know, it's so egregious.
Yeah, like there's this one panel where Bulk and Skull are throwing dodgeballs at Squat and Babu, and both Bulk and Skull are in the exact same pose, except like Skull for some reason. Also, it's weird because he like very consistently draws Skull as being smaller than Bulk, when in the show they're the same height. So he's very committed to these archetypes too, where it's like, oh yes, the small
dude's name is Bulk. Okay.
No, but I love it. They look like the Toguro brothers from Yu Yu Hakusho. It's so awesome.
Yeah.
To Salt's point, at the bottom of the same page as the art supply fetish art, super funny. Actually, this is like almost a funny joke that I like. The bottom tier of panels, the I don't know these names. The green guy is grabbing something from somebody, and then Zed is taking it from him, and it is the same pose. Like, it's hilarious.
Yeah.
It's next to each other.
Incredible.
It's so funny.
Same placement of the, what is it, like, balls?
Yeah. Like, same size of panel,
same
everything.
Same size, same everything. Same. It's incredible. Anything else about Power Rangers before we move on to the VR Troopers side of things?
I'm going to say what you said about Power Rangers and double it for VR Troopers. Like, this is your note, but it is so striking that VR Troopers opens up with such a 1960s ass splash page. That is straight out of Doctor Strange or the Creeper, like something he was doing back then.
That first page in the VR Troopers comic honestly feels like something out of Shade the Changing Man, even.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we see later on that, you know, he's got the Doctor Strange window going on with one of the buildings. Like, it's so odd how much his art has changed within the span of even just like a few years, right? Because like I was saying before, this is only like a year or two off from, or not a year or two, like several years off from Chuck Norris, which looks like a completely different era of Steve Ditko, whereas this feels like almost crystallized in some ways.
Yeah, his art this in Chuck Norris looks different than like anything I've ever seen from him too. Like, that stands out way more. I think Power Rangers and VR Rangers look more like his Spider-Man stuff to me that I've read. Chuck Norris was a weird, like, super very blocky, way more blocky than he tends to be.
I mean this one definitely feels like he's having more fun in it. It's also kind of feels like, I don't know, maybe someone said an offhand comment about how he's faded. He's like, no, I still got it. Let me show you. Like,
I still got that VR.
Still like decided to go really hard on VR Troopers for some reason. And I mean, like, you know.
Well, he went hard on VR Troopers because he could draw a bunch of Chinese stereotypes. He's like, oh, racist. I got this.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying it's like a good reason. I'm just saying this is like,
I'll get a little silly with it. I'll draw some Chinamen.
Yeah. And they're also colored, like their what is it? Mentor, I guess, Tao, is drawn very much like a Wong from Doctor Strange. He also still just can't draw suits for like the when they're suited up in this, it looks like, you know what it looks like? Like those Star Wars, like those early Star Wars comics where they're making up, you know, like random bounty hunters.
Absolutely. I get that.
But yeah, I mean, VR Troopers, like, it's sick, honestly, just like how much his art just looks the same as it did as 20 years passed when this was, I even forgot, Squirrel Girl was only 4 years before this.
Oh, dang.
Yeah.
I mean, Squirrel Girl seems like a well-drawn book by comparison, you know? Like, this is just so bad.
Yeah.
I mean, there is, I'll say this compared to Power Rangers. Power Rangers has only, like, one panel of Power Rangers. They don't even show up after that. They don't even fight. That, like, he is doing some action here to give him some credit for that.
Yeah.
Yeah, to what I've been talking about this whole time about appealing, being a kid's comic and feeling like Ditko is trying to make things for kids in different ways. This actually feels like it could be a bad Spider-Man comic that a kid would enjoy. You know, like, comparable to that. This could be a comic that, like, a kid reads and goes, oh, okay, like, pew pew, I'm a VR Ranger now afterwards. And it isn't like doing the
philosophy
stuff.
I can see someone that's like bought into the mania of Power. Like, because back in the early 90s, there was like a mania for Power Rangers. So I feel like anyone who was caught into that would probably enjoy this comic.
Yeah.
Like, they probably wouldn't question the dated looking elements of the comic.
Yeah.
I have one more. I have one more final thought on Ditko doing these two books specifically. And it's about Ditko's thoughts on objectivism and, like, creator credit. There's this supreme level of irony here. Like, Spider-Man was never officially branded as Stan Lee's Spider-Man, but unofficially it was. And Stan Lee put his name on so many other things. Like that feud between Lee and Ditko is prolific. But when you look at VR Troopers and Power Rangers, you see that big Saban name at the top. And Saban didn't do anything. These are, you know, what made him such an awful guy is this is other people's work. This is the work of the Japanese creators, whether it's the character designers, the actors, the suit actors. Then there's the American side of things, like the American cast. All these people were exploited by Saban. And Saban is putting his name in big letters on these logos. And then Steve Ditko is basically crawling back to work for a guy who's arguably even more exploitative than Stan Lee. It's just phenomenal.
While at Marvel, too.
Right.
Like, it's the doubling up of it that gets me. It's like he had this huge ideological battle with Stan Lee back in the 60s and 70s, and then 20 years later he's back doing VR Trooper comics at Marvel using the Saban branding.
It's wild. It's just the perfect example of how contradictory and nonsensical all this objectivism and self-preservation philosophy is.
I mean, as long as the work gets done, right?
That's right.
That's all that matters. All that matters.
But I don't have anything else to say about these two books.
All right, cool. I mean, anything else from Serge, Keegan?
I mean, good.
No, not really. I think that's kind of said it all. It is kind of funny, though, like to see like this weird back and forth and kind of like these ideals play out in real time. I find that kind of bizarre in some ways, like, you know, especially with someone like Ditko, who's like, in comics, I guess, so synonymous with not only characters, but like, again, objectivism, like an actual core philosophy. So to kind of watch the like rise and fall of this idea play out in his career is kind of just a bizarre experience, I think, in a lot of ways.
Yeah. We've been through quite a lot of tales, some of the strange kind, some of the avenging kind. But, you know, we're going to wind down our journey with a look at his Fantagraphics exploits. Actually, exploit, because it was only one issue. Yes, we're talking about Steve Ditko's Strange Avenging Tales, published in February of 1997 by Fantagraphics. Probably like one of the lesser controversial creators in their stable, now that I think about it. Yeah, so this was announced as a quarterly ongoing series from Ditko, and he actually produced two issues for the series, but after a production mishap with the first issue, the second issue just got canned, and we never saw the rest of what Steve Ditko would have been capable of producing for Underground Comics after that.
I will defend this one. This is, even though he is in hack era, he is mostly not doing hack work here. This is cool.
Is good. Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree.
It's interesting. Like it's not Chuck Norris, but very few things are.
True.
This, like, it's odd, because when we're talking about the visual style and the visual changes between his art, like, this is literally a year off from VR Troopers, right? But the art here is much more experimental and much more just visually interesting than anything in the books from the decade prior.
The thing this is reminding me of, wildly, well, there's like, well, the main thing is like Asterius Paul era Mazzucchelli. Not that it's the same, but it's the same kind of vibe of like, all right, this is, I have been doing this for so long. I am good at it, and I'm going to make a thing that has meaning to me. Because that's what I think Asterius Polyp is for Mazzucchelli. And like, dude's cooking here. There's a lot of good stuff in here, and it's just like fundamental good cartooning is what it is. It's not and you can tell, well, I think one of the big differences between this and the other ones, well, because like going through the other ones, I was like, this dude just doesn't know how to do this anymore. Like, he just can't. And I think it's a mode, right? It's his mode of writing for kids, writing children's comics. Is he's bad at it at this point in his career. And then that just causes unforced errors. And then there's also the like mandatory fighting that has to happen in superhero comics that he knew was true and definitely thought was true in that output. But this just shows like, nah, this dude could do stuff. He's a weirdo. He's a weird guy. But he can make a comic.
Yeah. I also want to point out, it's kind of funny how he seemed very aware of how Fantagraphics like weird indie looks, like their unique indie looks, and just kind of like tailored his comic to be like that. And I find that like really, really kind of hilarious, because this is not like, this is not a thing he had to do. It's Steve Ditko. People are going to buy the comic. And, you know, like, but like to do that anyways, just feels like a very like, you know, like we were talking about before, where it does seem like, you know, any other failing aside, it does seem like he very much has his finger on the pulse of like things going on in comics world or things going on that he's at least aware of, you know. And I found that kind of fascinating in this comic particularly.
The first story is the strongest. That's the one I mainly appreciated. It's the Baffler. And there's a lot of strengths here. For one, Ditko is working primarily in ink washes. So he's using some like grayscale and thicker line work and not so rigid line work you're used to. It's cool to see him flex his style, and it's different. Even though it has some vibes from something like Mr. A, it's not like Mr. A. It's literally more fluid.
Yeah, I think in general this feels a lot less like essay like than the previous one, where
there's no moralizing, like, no eulogizing.
I mean, there are like still morals, I guess, like there is a moral of the story, I guess, to each short, but I guess it doesn't feel as charged as it did with Mr. A.
Well, because Mr. A, half the page was those walls of text.
Yeah.
And this is actually letting the art do the talking, which is makes it really fun read.
Yeah.
I also like that this character, the Baffler, is this like perfect continuation of all of his like suit characters, like dress suit. Like there's this through line from the Question to the Creeper to Shade the Changing Man to this character. Like he just keeps evolving on this one concept, which is fun to see.
Yeah, I mean, even when he's doing like, you know, the delinquent characters, right? Like when we looked at his delinquent characters in Mr. A, in even stuff like the Creeper and the Question, right? Like it feels like he knows that this is an iteration on that, and he is not necessarily trying to reinvent himself, but like he is pushing himself in a way that we just were not seeing with any of his comics in the decade prior.
Yeah. The other short story I want to talk about here, where he does get a bit into philosophy, is this one called The Litterer. It starts with like screaming SJWs. Like it feels like a Soyjack comic, you know?
I love it so much.
And then it actually goes like all their like complaining and stuff. But then it goes in a slightly different direction than you think. It has this guy littering everywhere until he gets his comeuppance from this magic wind that blows him into a trash can. I don't know what you guys got from it, but for me, it was like Ditko is saying these environmentalists are deluded. They're missing the forest for the trees. Instead of raging about the planet's health or wishing to regulate pollution, we should instead be focused on personal responsibility. Everything would be fine.
Yeah.
I mean, that's objectivism, right? Like the idea that everyone's the hero of their own story, and it's up to them to actually, like, it's odd. It's not like he's like anti-environmentalism. It's more so that like he's just tired of these damn liberals screaming at him. You know, like, if he wants to save the world, he can do it himself.
The loony left wants there to be coral reefs in 10 years.
Yeah. I'll have a say about what the coral reefs will look like 10 years from now. Let me handle it.
Let's get Ayn Rand on these Californian fires.
Should have just raked the leaves up. I don't.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you rake those leaves up, those forest fires wouldn't happen.
Why wasn't Gavin Newsom raking the leaves? We need to get to the bottom of this.
Yeah, if you pay, see, this is what happens when you pay your taxes instead of doing your own work and being productive. If you were a productive member of society, that forest fire wouldn't have happened. Oh,
it's true.
It's like Smokey the Bear, but for objectivism.
Oh, we need that. We need that character. That'd be really good.
Mr. S.
Yes, I'll bring him back. Yeah, the first two short stories here are the strongest. The other ones, there's not much to say, but it is really cool to see Ditko playing with different line weights and hatching and stippling and all the other stories he does here.
The first story, especially where he's like doing the different inking styles within the same panel, is really, really sick. And then there's the other story really later on where he's drawing characters as silhouettes made of hatches, which is like, ugh, so good.
Yeah, that one's also really cool. I think my favorite story, though, is the Undis player. This dude just dies.
I don't even know what happened in that one. It's so weird.
I so much. He's like, what the fuck?
He's like a Mr. Bean type guy who tried to pick up one book and like burn down the whole library.
I don't understand what it means at all, but I'm crying. It's so funny to me. Like, what was he cooking?
Well, man, you know, objectivists are big proponents of honoring the Dewey Decimal System.
It's nonsense. It's so funny.
It's so like, wacky. And
that's one of my things about him. Is like, I would love to be able to talk. I don't know his brain. If he was even capable of this, but like, talk to him like a person. And like, what's happening, dude? Like, what are your thoughts? Because like, this whole book, I like this book. I think this is a good comic, like fundamentally, even if the philosophy is nonsense. But like, he's funny. This is like five panels of comic. And it's like a hilariously executed joke. And
yeah, it's incredible. He walks in, you see the books getting shuffled around. He goes, how awful, nothing for me. And then he like slips up like he's just slipped on a banana peel and just
it's like a Rick and Morty. Why?
It's like a Rick and Morty bit.
It's hilarious. It's so funny.
This is like Jerry from Rick and Morty. This is just what
yeah, you have to know you're funny, right? Like, he had to know that was hilarious, that was funny, and that he, like, had good comedic timing there, which is difficult to do in a comic. It's hard for people to make funny comics. And, like, he was just so crazy. I don't know, man. I just want to have a beer with Steve Ditko, I think.
Yeah.
Just to dissect him.
Just really figure out what he was thinking, you know, like what made him, what compelled him to. I feel like DJ Funk Flex during that one Tyler the Creator freestyle where he's like, what made you go with that verse? That's how I feel reading most of this comic.
And like, artists are liars too, you know, like George Lucas has lied so much about Star Wars constantly. Every year he says a new lie about Star Wars. And so it's like, well, read the work. Don't listen to the lies. And like, there's something there with Ditko where he's an insane person, but all we have is his work to base that off of, and like interviews too. But
well,
like,
we don't have interviews, though. He did not do interviews, famously.
Yeah. Exactly. So, like,
I mean, this is...
Anecdotes.
Yeah. So actually, I do want to talk about that, because at the end of this book, we have this little bit from, I assume, Gary Groth, where he compiles, like, excerpts from other interviews, from interviews with other people, where Ditko gets brought up. And it's really, really weird, because it's like, some of these interviews are like directly talking about Steve Ditko, and it's just like, why would you do that? Like, well, yeah.
They're all just like, man, why do you love Ayn Rand so much? He's just like,
yeah, like
you're just all talking crap on his philosophy.
Had Ditko been brainwashed by Rand by that time? So funny.
I love seeing Ditko get dunked on in a book, like all the way back in our first
his own making,
yeah,
right? Like,
it's
like if Tom King were to release a book and the back matter was just like other people talking. Like if they were just, if they just posted tweets talking about him as the back matter.
Yeah, but like Gil Kane's interview is really funny because he's like, he'll praise Ditko and then the same sentence be like, yeah, this was a, this, nothing is real. None of this was like making any sense to me. Like he's saying exactly what Keegan's saying.
Yeah.
Ditko's a loon.
Yeah. Just he's an like, insane he's person. Such a powerful individual, but he's also insane. It's just, yeah. It's amazing.
I just want to talk to him.
I do want to, I do kind of think about that though. You know, like, I bring this up all the time that like comics used to be like these weird countercultural weirdos and like people into like really weird philosophies and stuff now. And like, you know, so like with Ditko like seems strange. And you remember like this is the same industry that had like Alan Moore and Grant Morrison and like, you know, like all these other people that were pretty like just out there with their philosophies. And I think about that a lot. And I feel like there is something really lost by that. We don't have like people like this anymore. You usually just have people that are like either not wanting to alienate Comicsgate or you know, like
actual like horrible center, people.
Yeah, or like center like libs actual- that just like wanna like do platitudes, you know, you're, and like
when it comes to the counterculture, your options are anodyne and literal pedophile. That's it. That's it. That's all you have now.
Yeah.
No, I fully agree with what you're saying, Serge. Like, it's one of the rare things that Grant Morrison said that I think still really holds up is, like, even a lot of that mainstream work in, like, the mid-20th century, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, it was a lot of outsiders. There was a lot of people with middling to above-average talent who couldn't get work anywhere else, and they had bizarre worldviews. And yeah, now it's just all, like, Ivy Leaguers and centrist libs.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's no longer it's like a working class industry, right? We were literally just talking about this in the Villalobos server, Keegan, yeah. with this idea that, like, yeah, the working class comics artist, what does that mean nowadays?
Yeah. I mean, I think about that a lot, especially like, you know, again, like Ditko is not like an obscure figure by any means. And at this point, people like Ditko, people like Alan Moore, you know, some of these people, even if they were somehow upper class weirdos, you know, like they just wouldn't be tolerated in some ways because comics are largely corporate structures and there's like so many obstacles to like people just kind of throwing in stories and getting these jobs. It's just such a bizarre thing sometimes that, like, you know, when you look at some of these other authors, they wore their opinions on their sleeve too. It was like, it wasn't like anyone. Steve Ditko's an objectivist. I never knew that. It's like, no, like Spider-Man and Dr. Strange would go on these rants in the middle of their comic for like
several years. Yeah, yell at protesters in the middle. Like,
oh, I think his full name is Objectivist Steve Ditko. Like,
yeah. I mean, like, and even Alan Moore would just make fun of him by like making Rorschach, right? And like, which I also find funny, like that other comic writers will be like, yeah, you're insane. I'm going to like make fun of you in a comic too. Well,
that's what I love about the first issue of Doctor Strange. It's Stan Lee saying, Stephen Strange, you're so strange. You're such a weird guy.
Oh man.
Yeah. Before we close things out here for real, let's talk about his work after this. Cause after 1997, things really started drying up for him. He only did one more comic for Marvel after this. I think it's called something to do with like light and magic. And then afterwards, he did a one-shot with Mark Miller, which was only printed like a decade later in the Tales of the New Gods trade paperback, which I can't find a single scanned copy online, so we only have the one picture to go off of. I don't know, maybe it's on DC Universe Infinite or whatever. But yeah, his work really started to dry up after Strange Avenging Tales, and it got to the point where the only work that he was doing was with Robin Snyder, his longtime editor and work partner. But I didn't know this. Did you know that he was doing Kickstarters with Robin Snyder for like several years prior to his death?
That's wild.
Oh, man. What? This is the fate Kickstarter.
That sounds incorrect.
Fate of every creator is just going to Kickstarter or Indiegogo now.
That's insane.
his work after Fantagraphics, after Marvel, after DC was mostly reprints, but also producing some new content. I think he was doing like essay work too. Yeah, with Robin Snyder. And like I'm looking at these like projects, and it's crazy to think that like he was doing this stuff while in this like late stage. Like when you think about documentarians, journalists, all trying to like find Ditko in the last years of his life while, you know, these Kickstarters are going on. He's like putting out work, and these Kickstarters are still kept going after he died too. Like after he died, Snyder kept working on putting out some of these Kickstarters.
Huh.
Like the latest one, I think, came out like last year.
I think amazing. I've poked around these Ditko forums, and I can't specifically speak for Snyder, but I feel like a lot of these people, they feel that Ditko was kind of a champion of objectivism, right? So like, you know, they did believe in his art, but it was like a two-way street. Like, we are fans of Ditko. We want to get his art out there, but we want to also get his art out there so we can spread the word.
Yeah.
Mm.
Like, a lot of this is Mr. A-esque screed.
Right.
Right? But it's wild to think that he was still doing this, though. Like, it's weird. When you think about the latter stage of a comic artist's career, or even just a comic writer's career, right? Like, I feel like it's a conversation that we keep having every now and then where it's like, what do you do with a comic writer when they get old? Like yeah. What is yeah. aging out
yeah.
when it comes to comics creation?
I think about that so much because, go ahead, Serge.
Oh, I was going to say, you always see them at like the conventions and they're always like the sad older guy. And like, I love talking to them because they're like always kind of like really interesting people. I bought one of the comic, a pulp magazine from one of the guys. And he was like, yeah, I used to draw Conan in the 70s and write some of these like pulp ones and like all sorts of things. So I bought a magazine off of, you know, one of his, and he autographed it for me. But like, it is just kind of sad because they're all just sitting there, you know, like everyone's kind of ignoring them. And I'm like, well, like, they kind of deserve a place too in this like discussion. Like, maybe they didn't write your favorite Conan series. Maybe they didn't write anything of note even, but like, it just feels way weirder and more heartbreaking to see like some of these people that are, you know, like, again, like this is just kind of how they're going to make their living. Just going to these weird conventions and selling older prints that they have. And I mean, like, you know, and the worst part is like, this is almost every comic artist and writer. Like, even the top tier guys are still having to do this kind of thing to etch out a living. They might be a little more comfortable
yeah.
and having to rely on that income. Again, like, I bring up like Larry Hama as a great example where he just said, like, I have to keep doing this. But like, you know, it's just really bizarre and upsetting at times. And it's just, but like, again, like, you know, at the conventions, I think they're like, they're sometimes the most fun people to talk to because they're not swarmed with people. They actually have time. They're actually like really thrilled to like hear people are, they just like love the idea that people are in comics still. And I think that's kind of like, there's something really beautiful about that too, I think.
Yeah. I mean, when we joked about it a bit when we were talking about the Power Rangers comics, like, but like, what is Frank LaVise up to these days, right? Like, what's John Strom up to these days? Like, when you think about like transitioning out too, right? Like, so many comic writers end up becoming screenwriters or, you know, vice versa. But like, for Steve Ditko and his objectivist ideals, making comics was the work, right? Like, we never really saw him go into other mediums, right? Like, even when he was putting out Complete Dreck, like with Power Rangers, like with Chuck Norris, it was still him working in the medium that he wanted to work in, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I talk about this a lot. I've talked about it with a bunch of different people about, like, aged workers. This is a worker. This is a labor issue. It's a worker issue. Like, you have, especially in industries, in creative industries, it's like, they don't necessarily have a savings. They don't necessarily have a way to make money. And like, the way we talk about older comics creators versus like older directors is a really specific tell for me, because it's like, with older directors, we're like, yeah, I can't wait for Megalopolis, you know, late era is gonna be sick. It's gonna be great. Or, you know, we're always,
even Spielberg's latest thing, right? Like,
yeah, like these,
or
are
old. Even George Miller, right? People,
George Miller, yeah. Just hang out with it, right? And we're always just like, yeah, like, this is great, whatever, it's awesome. And the saddest part to me is like, the the money quotient isn't even a thing for those guys. These guys are extremely successful and wealthy our tours. Like they are guiders of culture, and they have money to keep TCM going and stuff like that. And then you get to comics and it's like, man, these throwback minis suck. Ugh. These Peter David shouldn't be working. Blah blah blah. And yeah, I know there are moral things here too, but like
JM DeMatte, that's the I'm here supporting JMD.
I also think
yeah,
there used to be a clear pipeline in comics too, where creators would become editors eventually, and I think that happened way more when the companies were smaller and the lines were more easy to manage, and you had art directors on staff, and then you go from being a creator with a page rate to a company. You know, I'm getting retirement and everything like that. And that was the clear direction. But now that doesn't happen. And now, really, because of Image being the way it's built, everybody could just, all right, yeah, you're just going to option it anyway. So you're the next Robert Kirkman. You're going to have a movie. You're going to have a studio. So just go sell your ideas, and then, you know, come to Marvel and DC to do a little bit of bullshit. But like, there's no, it just sucks. It sucks because all of that means that we can dispose of these older creators who maybe aren't doing great work, but like, that's because of the working class nature of comics. That's because of the formation and the history of comics being what it is, being a thing that like, you're just always going to be doing it. And that's just how it is.
Yeah. I mean, what are we to do? Like, I think about that post that Larry Hama made about like, he can't afford to, you know, give away free shit, right? Like, he has to work because work is all that he has to sustain himself nowadays, right? Like, how many creators are forced to use the Hero Initiative's services? And it's not to talk about the Hero Initiative. It's great that it exists, and you know, like, it's the systemic factor of it where it's like, it's just not sustainable to be a comic creator anymore while also having, like, I don't know, with like, the term sellout comes up very often, and it's weird that I don't think that Ditko sold out here. Like, he had his clear hack era, but, like, I don't think at any point I would say that he necessarily sold out either, right? Like, yeah, he was literally just doing what he wanted to, you know, fit his ideal of objectivism.
Yeah, I am thinking of Cates a lot right now as we're talking. Well, I'm thinking of Cates a lot recently anyway, but, and thinking about how, like, and Tynion and even Zdarsky, and I think all three of them probably sold out to a higher degree than Ditko did. And part of that's philosophy, right? Ditko, I'm going to work, I'm going to have a job, I'm going to be a productive member of society. Whereas the other three, all of them, like, cashed in on popularity at key moments and leveraged that into a more soulless job or work on some level. And in different ways too, right? Tynion's was all about branding himself. Oh, I'm a Batman writer. Now I'm going to start Tynion Onion Studios and turn my books into shows and movies. Or Cates just kind of like going all in on his personal fandom, in a similar way, but different because he's stuck more at Marvel and stayed in those minds. So like, it is interesting to talk about selling out in that context of like, I think it matters what you are, what the work is for, and like how you leverage it, I guess.
Yeah. I think the big difference, you know, when you talk about someone like, you know, like Tynion and some of these guys, Tynion, I don't know how to say it, versus
Tynion,
like Ditko.
I think it is.
Tynion. Anyway, yeah.
I thought Tynion was a pun, but whatever. I don't know. Oh,
I have no idea. I mean, I guess the difference is like Ditko had an idea, and he was using comics as a medium to explore this idea, and this was a preferred idea. You know, like, objectively, this philosophy. And I feel like a lot of times when you look at, like, a lot of more modern comic writers, you know, the goal is to sell out. Like, the highest achievement is to be made into IP that will be made into a movie, so to speak. And I think that's, like, where I can't fully hate on what Ditko's doing in some ways, because, like, again, as we said, well, like, he kind of didn't need the money, but he still kind of, like, was trying to put his ideas in any way he could in this industry, right? And, you think about, like, when you look at, like, someone like Alan Moore or, like, Jonathan Hickman or some of these people where they're, like, if this company or whatever doesn't take me and want me to toy with these ideas, I'll go find somewhere else to play with my toys. You know, and Alan Moore famously going to, like, a whole other medium now. And I think, like, that's where, like, the distinction of sellout versus, like, artist kind of resides at this point for me, is that, like, when you look at what they're doing, they're still trying to do things, and the goal isn't just like, man, I really hope I get an adaptation. You know, and I think it's weird that that's the distinction now, like, the bar is so low, but it's also funny how few people make that clear that at this point in time, and I find that, like, even weirder at times when you look at the industry and how bleak that is.
Yeah
Well, it's time we walk ourselves into oblivion. Yeah, I mean, that, right. I think that really does just cover it. Anyone else have any other thoughts on Steve Ditko before we close this chapter?
R.I.P. King.
R.I.P. I don't know about King specifically, but...
made me cry.
Remember, he's an objectivist. He's an objectivist. Yeah, I don't think he would prefer being a king.
R.I.P. Right. Citizen.
Productive citizen.
Yeah, R.I.P. productive laborer. Citizen. Thank you, laborer. You did a creator. Lot of productive work. Thank you for being a productive member of society, Steve Ditko. We salute you.
We have valued your labor.
Thank you for taking the whole of society and shouldering it for the majority of your life. And also big ups for Power Rangers, man. What'd you think about season 3? You know, all the objective stuff, you know, screw all the ideology stuff. I want to hear Ditko's thoughts on Power Rangers when I meet him in the afterlife.
Yeah, when you guys are chilling in hell.
Yeah. he might go. Be a couple rungs underneath me. I don't know. Yeah, we'll see. Maybe. Yeah. Gotta, like, dip down into the seventh circle. Just be like, yo, Steve, what's up?
So about it's Power just Rangers. Freaking out because he has nothing to work on.
Yeah.
You didn't have to torture yourself for me. I'm worse than you.
Yeah. Can you imagine just living an objectivist life only to end up in, like, one of the deepest rings of hell?
Well, I mean,
yes. I can very much imagine that.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, if you're an objectivist, you're like, oh, I belong here, right?
Yeah. Basically. Yeah.
I'm no longer productive. Time to go to hell.
Yeah. Damn.
Is an objectivist dies.
I'll get us started with the grab bag. I have a rec from a friend of the pod, Artyom. Artyom recommended the Netflix live action adaptation of, I don't know if I'm saying this right, Golden Kamuy?
Golden Kamuy.
Kamuy. Golden Kamuy. Thank you. It was really good. I was not familiar with the series at all before, and it's a really fun, brutal yet slapsticky action comedy.
Nice. I still need to read the 31 volume. Well, I've read most of it, but I need to finish the 31 volumes of Golden Kamuy that I have sitting on my shelf, which I probably could have gotten to faster if Serge didn't recommend that we read the entirety of Kathan Stegman's Venom last time.
Thank you, Serge.
Oh, man. It'll be worth it.
I sure hope so, Serge. I sure hope so.
I feel like it's going to tie in nicely with Ditko, because it's like... So it'll feel like a thematic thing.
Just like how it was thematically similar to Watchmen.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. You got it in one.
Yeah.
Alex, yeah. Okay, we don't need to record the episode now.
Yeah, cool. Yeah. Right. Serge, what do you recommend?
I just saw Furiosa. Go see it. It's amazing.
It's good. It's really
good. I think the best thing I can say about it, too, is, like, if you love Fury Road... You'll love this movie, and it's like, it's not like Fury Road either. I think that's, like, one of the things that's great about it is, like, it gives you more without just feeling like I should just watch Fury Road again. But you should watch Fury Road again anyways.
It's a really good side story to Fury Road.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, Furiosa is mine.
Nice. Keegan.
So basically, okay. I remembered my other one. But I have basically only been watching or reading things for this. For the podcast lately. So every week I've had like one thing that I've been like, oh yeah, okay, I have that. But I kind of have two things. So one is I got to read the new Ultimates number one a little early. And
no, why is that, Keegan?
My comic shop owner is a real homie. This nice. Is why. I am not.
All right,
not
authorities, get this man. Critic. Get this man.
I'm not a filthy critic who got it early. I'm not a friend with a filthy critic who shared it with me early. I'm not friends with shop owner friend. And I got a copy, and then I. But
I don't know if you can admit to that on the podcast.
You can cut that out.
Okay.
If you want to search, I'll send it to you though. Anyway. the whole Ultimates line is so good though. It's rad. It's a great line. So I'm gonna shouts to that, enjoying it a lot, except for the Messina art. And then my other one is sort of Friends at the Table, but not Friends at the Table. So there's a composer for the podcast Friends at the Table, Jack DeQuidt, Quidt. And all of his music he composes for it, he has on Bandcamp. And it's been like my reading music, because there's no lyrics in it. And it's just nice music. A lot of different genres. There's like experimental electronic stuff and like very light, like just a lot of acoustic stuff. And it's good. They're all broken into albums based on the different seasons that they worked on. And that's good. So Jack DeQuidt, Quidt at Bandcamp. All his music from Friends at the Table is my other grab bag.
Nice. As for me, I've only got the one recommendation this week. It's because I forgot to recommend it last week. The Sympathizer. It's so good. I'm talking about both the book and the recent HBO series, which I did not watch on Max. If we're continuing this piracy thread going on here. Yeah, it's really, really good. The last episode especially, it's very, very unsatisfying, and I mean that in the best way possible. There's a lot to chew on in it. It's really got me thinking about just the fact of being like the son of refugees. Like, it's such a well-crafted narrative, and I really hope that they either do a second season based off of the sequel book, or, you know, that if they don't do that, that all the actors, except maybe Robert Downey Jr., go on to do much, much more work. The main lead, Hua Shande, is just so fantastic. And I can't recommend it enough. I like, no matter what other show comes out this year, I genuinely think that this is going to be very solidly in my top three. So
have it
if you
on
haven't,
my iPad.
Good. Yeah,
been
so
watching
that's...
movies. I've been reading Venom.
If you had less Venom to read, you'd have more time to watch The Sympathizer.
I know.
You just have more time to read other Venom comics.
Yeah, of course. I honestly, worse ones. Because
worse ones,
I don't
yeah.
think Al Ewing or Rob V made better Venom comics than I've read so far. So
it was like that was like the monkey's paw moment of Venom for me. Man, when that announcement came out.
Yeah. Well, if you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to support the show, we have a Patreon at patreon.com/midnightgrapplerAnimals. You can, you know, join at $1 to vote on future topics, much like this topic. This topic was a viewer chosen topic. But if you want so much bonus material, we've got the draft pick going on right now. We've got two bonus episodes every month. We've got a whole bonus exclusive series starting either next week or no, it would be next week by the time this episode comes out. So if you want to tune in to any of that, just toss us $5 and you can do that. So, I mean, if you can't do that, you can always just give us a good review on your podcast app of choice. Please get the word out. Tell your friends. Listen to Midnight Grappler Animals. It's not like they're listening to Mex Mentayo. Otherwise, if you have questions, comments, or suggestions for the show, you can email us at midnightgrapplerAnimals@gmail.com. If you want to join our Discord server, This also goes to anyone in the Villalobos Robotics server. If you're listening to this and want to join our server, you can find links to that in our social media pages.
Our equally active server.
Our equally active server. Some might even say more active at times.
This is like our come to Death Row Records moment.
As long as we're not bad boy. Yeah, so you can find all those links in the description down below. And as all... And as always,
keep on grappling.
Keep on grappling.
There you go. As always, we'll edit in post.
As always.
As always.
That's a good. That would be a good.
Keep on editing in post.
Keep on editing in post. There we go.